going to open up the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. Today we're still waiting for a couple of members, but we do have a quorum. I wanted to make one announcement. The work session on House Bill 2227 will be held over. Right. We're waiting for some paperwork on that. So it may be tomorrow, maybe next week. It's probably going to be next week. My guess is Tuesday
tomorrow.
Or Thursday. We're meeting tomorrow.
Friday.
Tomorrow's Friday.
Well, that's
yes,
right.
We're
meeting tomorrow.
And that's a good segue to my next announcement is we
that?
Have a Friday 1 p.m. meeting, and we will be meeting in Hearing Room A. So if you come here, I'm not sure what will be here, but we won't. So please come to Hearing Room A. With that, we'll open up our first public hearing, which is on H.J.R. 35. And Beth, you can explain the bill.
Madam Chair and committee members, H.J.R. 35 has a no revenue or fiscal impact. It expresses support for findings of report issued by the Federal Forest Lands Advisory Committee. It expresses support for effort by governor to form group to oversee implementation of report.
Okay, and we have Representative Chris Edwards. Would you like the Department of Forestry to come up with you, or...? Why don't you go first, and we can...
I'll just kick it off, and then
You gotta run.
I gotta run.
Okay. Welcome.
And I'm really not the one to answer the really substantive questions, but I do appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of this committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state representative in House District 14, which represents West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. I'm particularly interested in House Joint Resolution 35 because as the son of somebody who not only grew up in the timber industry and has worked in nearly all aspects of that industry from the mill or within mills, from pulling green chain to management and ownership, and I myself also being one that has worked in mill management as general manager of a little company called Western Wood Products, our family company, before running for the legislature, I've been frustrated by not only how our federal forests have been managed, but I've also been frustrated by the tenor of some of the fights and the arguments, and it's kind of broken down into what can we do or what can't we do via the courts. And I think that this the work of this committee, the Federal Forest Lands Advisory Committee, is a step in the right direction for having a greater say as a state about what the federal government does or does not do with our forests in this state. And as much as collaborative processes can be frustrating at times, I think often they produce results that are more long-lasting and can withstand the test of not only of time, but the test of politics and the test of the courts. So that's really what House Joint Resolution 35 is about, is expressing this legislature's support for the findings of the Federal Forest Lands Advisory Committee. It did pass out of the House on a 57, something like that, to zero vote. And we thank you for hearing the resolution. And as far as the specifics, I would leave it to the experts from the department to speak to each particular specific. I would note, one last note I would make, is that the Federal Forest Lands Advisory Committee really represents a diverse group of stakeholders. And while this certainly won't get the most headlines of this session, if we were to move forward, and I'm not saying even that we will see the tangible results on the ground within the next 2 years, but if we were to move forward with the recommendations in this report, I think it could really, really change the direction and the tenor of some of those fights, and could get our federal forests working for us again. So,
Well, thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. Are there any questions for the representative? Comments?
No, I'm going to step out with him when he's finished.
Okay. Yeah. He's going to follow you, so watch out.
Okay.
But thanks for bringing this forward, and if you want to do you want to stick around for a minute? Will you hear the forestry?
Or you have to run I'll off? Talk with the senator, and I'll be watching on TV.
Okay.
Catching up.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so Kevin Birch from the Department of Forestry. Just let's see, add a few words.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We all have a copy of the...
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Birch from the Oregon Department of Forestry. I was the staff person who was most closely associated with the report, so if you do have any of those substantive questions to ask, I'm here to oblige that. I know you have a busy agenda, so I'll keep the remarks really short. First of all, of course, we support HJR 35. And we, because it endorses the recommendations of the Federal Forest Lands Advisory Committee, it was a very, very diverse group of stakeholders. We went to both ends of the spectrum to try and get as many opinions as we could get, and that group was able to reach consensus, a full consensus among all of the interests, and really try and chart a way forward on our federal lands. The central theme of the recommendations are really to use local collaborative processes as a vehicle to be able to assess forest conditions and then be able to design landscape-scale treatments for forest health. We're also heartened really by the amount of support and the number of groups that have tried to come together, broad interests have come together to try and implement these recommendations. Those include the Nature Conservancy, Oregon Business Council, Oregon Forest Resources Institute, Sustainable Northwest, as well as a host of state and federal agencies and others that have come forward and are working toward implementation. We think this is an important step forward and really hope that you'll endorse this resolution. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for the department? Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
And with that, would anybody else like to testify on HJR 35 before I close the public hearing? Okay. Close the public hearing on HJR 35 and open up a work session on HJR 35. Want to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I'd move HJR 35 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Atkinson moves that HJR 35 be reported out of committee with a recommendation to be adopted. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none. The motion passes and HJR is adopted. HJR 35 is adopted. And would anybody like to volunteer?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. He says that with a lot of enthusiasm, but... Oh, and Senator Przanski is excused. Thank you for reminding me of that. Okay, with that, we will close the work session on HJR 35, and we'll open up a public hearing on HJR 40A.
Madam Chair and committee members, HJR 40A recognizes Jane Lubchenco for her contributions to marine biology, understanding of climate change, and service to Oregon.
Okay, and I think we have another representative who would like to speak to this, Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46. Thank you for your kind treatment so far of bills coming from the committee that I chair at the same time over in the House, and hopefully kind treatment of me here today. There are actually two bills that I'll testify on, but starting with HJR 40. HJR 40 is about recognizing and honoring an important Oregonian. Her name is Jane Lubchenco. You've undoubtedly heard of her. She is the highest-ranking Oregonian in the new presidential administration. She's also the first woman to head the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA. Dr. Lubchenco has been a member for more than 30 years of the OSU faculty and has been among the most productive and celebrated members of that university. In fact, one of the most celebrated members in that university's 140-year history. She is one of only five OSU faculty members ever named to the National Academy of Sciences and has been honored with awards that include a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, 8 honorary degrees, and so on and so forth. Dr. Lubchenco's work has been broad and varied. She is a scientist. Her work recently, most recently, has focused on climate change. But I think what I want to stress is the way in which she has and her work has helped inform the public. She takes very seriously the scientist's role in helping engage the public, not just engage in a discourse with other scientists. She's provided testimony to Congress, addressed the United Nations, offered advice to the White House, federal and international agencies, so on and so forth. So I urge you to move this resolution in honor of HJR 40 to the floor, and in doing so, recognize a woman who is a model and inspiration, I think, to many Oregonians, and certainly deserves our applause and honors here in the Oregon Legislature.
Thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. And I didn't realize that she was the first woman to serve as the head of NOAA, so that's pretty amazing, actually, for all the years we've had NOAA, but not totally surprising. So that's great. Any questions for the representative? No comments? Okay. Thank you for bringing this forward. Anybody else that would like to comment on HJR 40? With that, we'll close the public hearing on HJA 40A, and we'll open up a public hearing on HJA 40A.
Madam Chair, I'd move HJA 40A be adopted, and that the report of that, and that the committee recommend it be adopted to the floor.
Senator Atkinson moves that HJA 40A be reported out at committee with a recommendation that it be adopted. It's different for resolutions. I know it's sort of strange. So any discussion? Okay. Any objections? All right. Seeing none. Motion carries, and I will carry it to the floor. And Senator Brzozinski is again excused. With that, we'll close the work session on HJR 40A, and we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3090A.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3090A, for the record, there's a no revenue or fiscal impact, prohibits provision in instrument conveying or contracting to convey fee title to real property, a prohibition on use of solar energy systems, or restriction on orientation or use of such systems in a manner that impairs effective operation.
Okay. And you might see that Representative Cannon is also the chief sponsor on this, along with myself, but I've asked the representative, since it's already gone through his committee, if he could provide us with testimony.
Sure. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And there's some other folks, I think, scheduled to testify, so I will keep my comments brief. Again, I'm State Representative Ben Cannon, House District 46. House Bill 3090 is, I think, a fascinating bill, and we had a really interesting conversation in the House committee about this. It looks more complex than it is. Essentially, what it does is prohibit a covenant, a homeowner's covenant, from restricting the use of clotheslines. There are some exceptions to that. If the clotheslines are in, you know, common space, that would be eligible for restriction. And I mean, the debate in the House committee had a lot to do, I would say, generally with the appropriate role of government restrictions and intervention in CC&Rs or covenants related to condominium associations or homeowners associations. What I would point out, there were some articulate folks who made the case that this was a very appropriate thing for the state to do. Regardless of your feelings on sort of the big picture, is this the right thing for the state to get involved in? I would point out that it is already the case that solar panels are protected from restriction under CC&Rs. Okay? And this bill amends that solar definition of solar panels to say renewable energy devices, I think maybe solar energy systems include both solar panels and clotheslines. Clotheslines are also energy-saving devices that reduce our use of energy, help reduce our impact on global warming, save people dollars, and if you're using them in your own backyard, it's not the business of a homeowners association to prohibit you from doing that. So it adds to the definition of solar energy device. It says clotheslines are also ones, and a homeowners association cannot restrict those. One other point on this, we also heard testimony, and perhaps you will too, that the primary effect of passing this type of legislation will be that that the template for these covenants that as new homeowners associations are formed, will not include restrictions on clotheslines. The current template does. So if you're establishing a covenant, a homeowners association's covenant, you would probably import, you know, start with a template for that covenant that restricts clotheslines. And you might look through it and say, well, that seems unnecessary, and so we'll strike it. But you very well may not. And the primary impact of this, I believe, would be to ensure that that comes out of these templates, and there are fewer of these restrictions on the books, and where they are on the books, they would be unenforceable. So you'll hear testimony from people who, at least one person, I think, who was directly impacted by one of these and has her perspective to share, but encourage you to move this one along. I think it's a small but significant way that we can support the Oregonians who are working to achieve energy independence, reduce their energy costs, and reduce air pollution and dependence on foreign fossil fuels. So that's my testimony.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? All right.
Thank you very
Obviously
much.
I'll
go back to my
computer. Run him over, yes.
All right.
Go back and don't send us more. No, I'm just kidding.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Next up, Ellie. Is it Ellie Spivak? Eli. Okay.
You're awesome.
And Susan Taylor. I'm going to be back right after this.
Okay.
Hi, welcome.
Hi, I'm Chair Dienfelder, members of the committee. Thank you so much for allowing this testimony. It's really exciting to be part of the process that tries to make Oregon the best it can be. And my experience started in this whole process 2 years ago when I decided to hang clotheslines against the CCNRs in my subdivision.
Yes. I'm sorry. Could you say your name?
I'm sorry. Place? It's Susan Taylor from Bend, Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. So 2 years ago, I decided to hang clotheslines against the CCNRs in our subdivision as a result of hearing a very dynamic lecture by Mary Wood, University of Oregon professor of law. And I felt I needed to do something to help with the crisis at hand for our environment, for our energy situation and economics. And so I hung my clotheslines up and started getting phone calls from the developer. I made formal requests to the developer asking them to amend their CCNRs to reflect the urgent need that we had to respond to the energy, economic, and environmental crisis. This got nowhere. After months of negotiating with the developer and trying to be compliant with their CCNRs, I made a screen device that failed with the Architecture Review Committee. I hung my clothes in the garage, and I was told that that was not acceptable. The garage doors had to be down. I hung my clothes outside, and my clotheslines were cut, and one thing led to another, and their final resolution, the developer, was to, rather than allow a 4-foot fence, they would instead allow a 6-foot fence so I could hide my clotheslines. And I said, thank you very much, but no thanks. It makes absolutely no sense to have to spend more time, money, and resources to be able to hang a clothesline. So as things developed, to kind of condense this whole thing, to my utter disbelief and surprise, I ended up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, followed by international and national news media as a result of just wanting to hang my clotheslines. I found this incredibly amusing and rather absurd, and I was totally blown away by the whole process. And after that, I continued to hang my clothes out. We'd put our house up for sale on the market, and I felt I had a pretty good chance of not being bothered anymore by the developers, since they were kind of getting some fairly negative publicity as a result. My intent from the beginning was, as I expressed to my neighbors and the developer, I was concerned about our future. I want a future for my daughter. And I said, what am I going to tell my daughter, that I'm more concerned about offending my neighbors than I am about her future in trying to conserve energy and decrease our carbon footprint on the planet? So, you know, being denied the right to conserve energy using clotheslines makes absolutely no sense. It's absolutely not in the public's best interest to continue to use expensive, polluting energy when we have great alternatives. So I don't think any of us would be sitting here today if we didn't feel passionate about trying to make a difference. And I think it's in the best interest for Oregon and for this country, and do what is right and allow passage of this bill. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for coming all the way over here today from Bend as well.
Hello, my name is Eli Spivak. Thank you, Chair Dinglefelder, and the rest of the committee. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm a developer and general contractor. And I got interested in this legislation about the third time I was handed condo docs from my attorney, and I sort of went through there and struck out certain clauses that I didn't like, including all the rules, including things like modifying the exterior of the buildings and doing clotheslines. And some of these communities, one of them I lived in, and I didn't want to have that rule in place. And I realized, and then my wife read that nationally, in Florida they passed a law similar to the one you're seeing here, and there's about 10 other states that have been looking at it. And we realized that probably the documents that I'm receiving by boilerplate are being adopted all over the state. And in talking with attorneys since then, that seems to be the case. It's hard to actually go and check. But there are at least 1,100 condominiums associations in the state. That's all I knew about at the time. But since then, we've learned there's about 10,000 homeowner associations or more. This is a lot of residents in our state who, even on a beautiful day like today, aren't allowed to use the sun, the breeze, to heat water, dry their clothes, what have you. So this legislation, I'm a pragmatist. I mean, I'm a developer, and I do small and medium-style condo projects. So I know that over the evolution of this bill, we've included some protections there, including some requested by the Community Association Institute, to make sure we can't just put solar clothes dryers on public, on common areas, or solar panels on the roof where they might cause damage. And there's some allowances for associations to restrict where things are located. As long as people have a right to use the sun to dry their clothes. And I wanted to share a couple little tidbits. One is the clothes dryer is second to the fridge only, is the most energy-intensive appliance in the house. And in terms of people who will take advantage of the statute, I don't think it will go like crazy, everyone putting in clotheslines everywhere. But people who want to help out the environment and aren't allowed to, since this bill started, I've had comments from dozens of people who live in condominium projects who are rule followers. They're not putting clotheslines up, unlike Susan, who's being the rebel. They're just not doing it, and they like to change the rules. I even know one attorney in Portland who, in his own condominium community where he lives, he just went with the standard documents, and he was hanging his clothes out to dry, and one of his neighbors pointed out it wasn't on the, he wasn't allowed to do that. And so it's on his list to change the bylaws at some point, but if you guys live in those associations, it's kind of a pain in the neck to do that. I mean, you actually have to go get it re-reviewed by the state of Oregon. You have to pay recording fees with the county. In practice, no one's going to do it for something like this. And last year I received, which I think is a rather common thing from the state, a list of all the different ways the condominium documents rules have changed based on the last session, including maintenance reserve. And I realized the state monkeys around with condominium and HOA rules regularly, and I think this is an appropriate place where there's a public benefit. And my hope is that, like in the House where it passed bipartisanly, there's been no organized opposition to this bill, it can be supported by this committee and go to the state Senate for review so that folks can, you know, save a little bit of money and not cost the state anything.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I have to say, I will admit, I hang my laundry up in the summer, and when I read the article, I think it was in the front page, I think you're also on the front page of the Oregonian, I was somewhat amazed and shocked and said, boy, there should be a law about that. So that's one of the reasons that Representative Cannon and I felt very strongly about it. And one of our former colleagues, moved to Bend and had also contacted us about it. I think you know former Senator Charlie Ringo.
Yes, I talked with him.
So, but I do have a question about whether or not, because I see here that it says specifies procedures by which a property owner may petition to remove provision mm-hmm. of the instrument. So does that help in your situation where it's an existing, because obviously this is going to prevent for future CCNRs. Does it help in your situation?
Well, in our situation where I live, we struck it before we got the documents reported.
Okay.
And if the association already exists, there is a process to amend bylaws usually, but it's troublesome. In practice, just like laws saying you can't sell to someone of a certain minority, those documents just become void and unenforceable. You don't actually have to go back and actually change it. But this statute does provide a path where people can make their documents comply with state law.
Christy, did you want to come up? I saw you coming up this way. Christy is staff for Representative Cannon.
Could I make one other comment?
Yes, certainly.
Presently, what's going on in my subdivision homeowners association, they are looking at how to deal with non-compliance issues. So if this bill doesn't pass, I may very well be fined as a result if I continue to hang my clothes out. And it just seems a bit beyond absurd. Thank you.
Christy, and for the record.
Yes. For the record, I'm Christy Split. I work for State Representative Ben Cannon. I'm also Eli's next-door neighbor. I just wanted to, I think Eli hit the nail on the head, but I want to make it clear that what this bill does is actually say that the question you asked was if people actually wanted to remove the offending language from their documents. And I think Eli handled it well, that this bill actually does say that it's no longer enforceable if you do have these provisions. And I think what it will do is start conversations. If you don't want clotheslines, then let's talk about people being able to put clotheslines in their backyards. So.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, Senator Przanski.
Susan, thank you for being here. Yeah. You should probably write a book about the memoirs of the clotheslines. So you did make a statement that someone actually came onto your property and cut the lines.
Yes.
Were they so bold and brave to leave a note and tell you?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, and it was done in the middle of the night. And it happened not only once, but twice.
We have a trooper in the back there. Maybe get Steve to run an investigation. But, Well, I'm sorry that you got such notoriety, but the reality is it's, sometimes you need to have those rebels that are getting out there and leading the way for allowing people to do what my parents' generation did day in and day out.
Yeah.
So, thanks.
Great. You're welcome. Any other questions?
No. Yes.
Okay.
I'll tell you what I find offensive on this whole deal.
Senator Atkinson.
The word offensive is that none of you said that your clothes smell better when they're on a line.
Oh, that's assumed.
I'm sitting here at Carbon Footprints and Wall Street Journals, but nobody said anything about the smell index.
And not only that, the clothes, you see all the lint in the dryer. That's part of your clothes. I mean, they'll last longer.
Right there.
Exactly.
It's a conspiracy.
But just the 1950s that clothes dryers.
Simple. We could have just said clothesline, three lines.
Yes. It was written by an attorney, don't forget. Or maybe.
I'm remembering that.
Well, thank you, all of you, and thank you, Christy, for coming up, and appreciate, I know it's been a long road to hoe, but hopefully it'll be over soon, and really appreciate the hard work that you all have done as well. Okay, would anybody else like to come up and testify on House Bill 3090A? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3090A, and I'll open up a work session on House Bill 3090A.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 3090A to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves that House Bill 3090A move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have clotheslines. And I understand the problem that's here, and I think we could do it in about two paragraphs, which is how we did it. So, anyway, there's my comments.
Okay. Thank you. Maybe in the next life you'll come back as a legislative council drafter and help us draft easier reading bills.
I would have never known. I read this bill, Madam Chair, and I would have never guessed we were talking about clotheslines.
I know.
And I'm not sure. This could be litigated, Counselor, for a while.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Any other comments or observations?
Yes,
Senator Przanski.
Madam Chair, just for the record, so if anyone does do any legislative history on here, we are talking about clotheslines.
Okay. With that, are there any objections besides to the drafting of the bill?
I'm going to object to the drafting of the bill. So.
Okay.
That's just to the bill.
End of the vote.
Okay. So noted. Okay, with that, the motion carries, and I will carry the bill. Okay, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3090A.
He was making it where it wouldn't be just limited to close lines.
And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2153.
I understand your problem.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2153, for the record, has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued. Allows Department of State Lands to impose civil penalties for certain uses of certain state lands, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, and we have Steve Purchase from the Department of State Lands. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Land Management Division for the Department of State Lands. I feel kind of silly getting up after the last testimony about clotheslines and talk about trying to issue civil penalties on behalf of the state, but I'm going to give it my best shot. And I know your agenda is pretty full this afternoon, so I'm going to kind of paraphrase my written testimony. I think most of you know that our department manages about 2.3 million acres of land within the state, of which about 771,000 is uplands. Most of those uplands are rangeland, agricultural lands, and forest land. The department, over the last number of years, has continued to experience unauthorized uses on our state lands, things like timber trespasses, road construction, ranching activities, farming activities. Seems to be our state lands have become a very popular place to do dumping of your trash as the land fees continue to go up. You can dump on our state lands for free. So we have put a bill in to try to give our agency the ability to assess a civil penalty for those unauthorized activity to get those individuals to correct that activity and to move forward to get the proper kind of authorization and or clean the land up. We have similar authority in our waterway program, and we've had it for many years now, and it's been a very, very effective tool for us to get waterway users into compliance by working them through a process and eventually, if we cannot get it corrected, to issue a proposed order with a proposed civil penalty that will go into effect after 20 days. And in those cases, most of those folks who get those kind of letters from us generally think, okay, the state is serious, we're going to try to correct this, and we bring them inside the tent and we are able to get them under authorization and get the issue resolved without having to issue the civil penalty. And that's a point I want to make sure that the committee understands. We can do that without having to go to a final order and issue that civil penalty. One of the things we've also experienced over the years is we're required under statute, under 273-185, to investigate and prosecute all trespasses on our state lands. And that puts us in a very awkward spot because you have to actually take a citizen of our state and charge him with trespass. And that's a very difficult thing to have on your record, both either as a criminal charge or possibly a civil charge, and it's very time-consuming and expensive for the state to go through that process, prove its case in front of a judge or a jury, and to wind up actually convicting that person of that activity. It's far much more expedient for us and much more cost-effective, and it's been a very effective tool in the waterway program to go ahead and issue those civil penalties as a tool to bring them inside state authorizations to get them to do the right things. So toward that end, proposed House Bill 2153 will add state-owned uplands to Department of Statutory Authority to issue a civil penalty for those unauthorized uses on our state lands managed by us, clarify that violations of 273-171 and 273-185 or any rule, order, or authorization adopted or issued by the Department is subject to civil penalties, makes it clear to the public that the unauthorized use of state lands are indeed illegal, and that persons using those assets in such a manner face civil penalties for trespass. Curtails unauthorized activities on our estate lands and provides additional revenue to the common school fund through the collection of civil penalties where necessary. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Thank you. And you're lucky you have three members of the Judiciary Committee up here. I was just thinking about that. Okay, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made mention, I mean, virtually everything in here are trespassing issues. How many successful trespassing cases have you guys been able to get prosecuted in the last year or a couple of years, or how many have you brought up and where have been the problems?
In the last year, we have had 16, Chair Dingefelder, Senator Boquist, in the last year, we've had 16 trespass cases on our uplands. We have not brought any trespass charges forward to date. One of the things that we realized when we were going through this process was it would be really great if we had some other way to deal with these besides issue a trespass citation. We have been able to resolve over the last year 14 of those. We have two outstanding at this point in time to deal with. One is a illegal farming activity, and one is a communication site lease on our state uplands in Harney County. So we have not filed any charges to date, but we have a couple on the docket that we're looking at.
A follow-up?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can you give me just a – you made mention, you know, they're hard to file cases. You haven't filed any, and I'm not the lawyer, so I'm not sure what – is it a trespassing is a misdemeanor or what it is, but I am familiar with the civil procedures, and they're almost as encumbersome, if not more encumbersome, of issuing a simple misdemeanor citation. So – can you expand on that? Is there a reason you haven't? You just tried to work through it. The district attorneys wouldn't prosecute it because it was too low of a fence.
Mm-hmm. Chair Dingefelder, Senator Boquist, both those answers are correct. In several cases, the county DA has been reluctant to prosecute and has encouraged us to try to find some other way to resolve those issues. We had an illegal dump right outside of Bend that we were pretty serious that we were going to have to go to a criminal trespass because solid waste site had been developed and trash and farm equipment and chemicals had been dumped in that trench. We really thought we were going to have to go there. The county DA was really encouraging us to try to resolve it some other way. We were very fortunate because Department of Environmental Quality kind of stepped in and helped us get that cleaned up under an order, so we were able to resolve that one without having to go that route. And I'm not an attorney either, so it'd be difficult for me to tell you all the process stuff, but my experience over the years that I've been at DSL is that generally takes anywhere from 3 months to a year to get through a process, a lengthy court process, particularly if you're going to prove anything that's related to criminal trespass. Criminal trespass is much more difficult to prove in court. The burden is much greater, and obviously the penalties are much greater. And our thought behind this was we'd rather not put Oregonians through that if we can avoid that, and maybe a civil penalty might help us get this resolved quicker.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Hess.
Comment, I guess, mm-hmm. Madam Chair. One of those bills you worked on in 2003 was
30 days in jail.
Establishing treble damages for elder abuse crimes, and the lawyers who work on those cases have told me that since that law went into effect, they've noticed a drop in financial elder abuse incidents. And in some cases, these lawyers can literally call unscrupulous salesmen on insurance and it would associate and unwind a deal because of this civil penalty. So I think there is something to be said for having this out there as kind of a deterrent for what you're talking about.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Senator? Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2153, and I will take a motion if the committee is ready.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2153 to the floor of the two-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2153 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments, discussion? Okay, any objection? All right, so noted that Senator Boquist. With that, the motion carries, and Senator Przanski is our resident attorney.
Okay.
Would you like to carry the bill?
Sure, why not?
Okay. All right, we will close the work session on House Bill 2153. And we'll open up work session on House Bill 2155. Oh, Senator Przanski is carrying it.
Oh, I'm
sorry. Public hearing on House Bill 2155.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2155A, for the record, there's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued. It authorized the Department of State Lands to assess a one-time fee for removal or fill permits valid over a period of more than 1 year.
Okay, and we have Kevin Moynihan from the Department of State Lands.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Moynihan, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands, Wetland and Waterway Conservation Division. And what you have before you, 2155A, is an evolution of a bill originally coming out of the House Committee. There are three items that are left in the bill right now for your consideration. One of those is a clarification and a reorganization of language in what we refer to as the agricultural exemption. That's in ORS 196.905. The language in the proposal is language that we worked out with the Farm Bureau, who's the primary stakeholder who's involved with the agricultural exemption. So for your consideration, we would ask you that you consider that. Item number two relates to an option that we do not currently have under the current statute that would allow the department to engage in an upfront billing on multi-year permits. Many of the removal fill permits that we issue are for more than 1 year. We can issue permits for up to a five-year period. We've gotten requests in the past from permittees for streamlining purposes so that they do not have to engage in responding to an annual billing request to allow us to bill them upfront for a multi-year permit. So we would propose that we be given the authority in the statute to do so. And our intention is that in rulemaking, we would make clear that it is at the discretion of the permittee to request whether or not they want to have that option on a multi-year billing up front. And then the third provision in the bill before you relates to a proposed exemption from regulatory permitting by the department for voluntary habitat restoration projects. These are projects that are primarily done in stream. They're stream restoration projects that support salmon recovery efforts. They're projects that have good beneficial outcomes for the resource, again, supporting recovery efforts. There's generally little, if any, natural resource impact associated with these projects. So we would propose that the department be given the authority by statute to by regulation exempt certain types of these voluntary habitat restoration projects. So with that said, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Okay, any questions for the department? And that's, so just want to clarify a couple things. First of all, that this is not a fee increase?
There is no fiscal impact. There is no fee increase,
okay,
Madam
so
Chair.
Okay, wanted to clarify that. And then regarding the new categories of exempted activities, I certainly appreciate having worked with watershed councils. I know that is appreciated for working with landowners trying to streamline the permitting process for restoration projects. So certainly appreciate to see that is being proposed here.
Madam Chair, this idea came out of an Oregon Solutions project that the Department of State Lands has worked on with the Oregon Trout, now the Oregon Freshwater Trust, to provide one less hurdle to encourage landowners who want to do the right thing to put in a stream restoration project to do so with the minimum of governmental regulation.
Okay. Any? Yes, Senator Boquist.
And you may not know the answer, but I'm just curious here because, I mean, there's nothing in the bill to indicate it, but 20 people voted against this. So just trying to figure out why in the world, any idea? I mean, it seems rather straightforward.
I have the director here. I think I'm going to ask Director Soliday to come up.
And Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, before Louise answers that, I can say that when the bill originally came through the House committee, there were other provisions in the bill that were fairly controversial. And following that committee hearing, we worked with those stakeholders and or we deleted some of those controversial provisions from the bill. So there may be some memory of that that's reflected in the vote.
Representatives don't read the bill either, right?
Madam Chair and Senator Boquist, I think what I actually checked with a couple of...
Louise, can you say...
Oh, Louise Holliday, Director of the Department of State Lands, sorry. Checked with some of the representatives about their no votes because we were surprised because it was on the consent calendar in the House, both of these bills. And they had a letter of concern that the Cattlemen's Association had put in on the original bill, didn't realize that we had worked out the concerns that had been raised, and so because they still had the letter in the file, they ended up voting no. So that's what happened.
This appears to be kind of like a streamline, and you're trying to make things simpler for people.
That's correct.
I didn't read the bill.
They
did not read the bill.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, if I could, it is partially a streamlining bill, and to pat ourselves on the back a little bit, we even have a new set of regulations for the removal fill program that deleted approximately 40 pages of regulations from the former regulations. So we are looking at issues like that.
You better keep that quiet. Everybody over here seems like more regulations.
I was going to say more is not always good.
Less is more, madam.
Right. All right, thank you for coming up on that. And I was going to ask, I see Katie Fast over there. I don't know if you, I anticipated that, read your mind. So come on up.
For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee, I just wanted to share that Farm Bureau did originally oppose the bill as introduced, but worked with the department on those provisions, and all of our concerns were addressed and now are, I would say, just neutral on the bill and are very grateful for the amendments that were made on the House side.
I think that answers Senator Boquist's question
I'm perfectly fine. Okay. I was curious. I read the bill.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Made sense.
All right. Thank you both.
It's like 11, 20 people. And it was Democrats and Republicans both
who voted
for it. Oh, yeah.
Let me ask Boyd to make it. Okay. So we'll close the public hearing. Actually, I should ask, did anybody else like to testify on this bill? Reopen it if you would. Okay, so close the public hearing on House Bill 2155A, and I will take a motion.
Madam Chair,
You have to do the work session. And open up the work session first. Boy, I'm trying to streamline here. That's the problem.
Right. Well, you can do them both. You could say public hearing and work session.
Yeah.
House Bill. Madam Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2155A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Przanski moves House Bill 2155A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections?
Yes.
Okay, so noted, Senator Atkinson. And with that, the motion carries, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2155A. Would anybody like to volunteer to carry this bill? I will do it.
Oh. I'll do it if you got other ones coming down. I'll be glad to take this one.
Okay.
Your choice.
I will, Senator Przanski. We have others coming down. So, actually, no, I will carry this one because we have another one coming down that you may want to carry.
Okay. Or you may get volunteered to carry it.
Right, you may get volunteered to carry that one.
I think is what she's saying.
Yeah. Okay. So, with that, we move on to, I think, another Department of State Lands bill, and the last one for today. We'll open up a public hearing in House Bill 2156A.
Committee members, House Bill 2156A, for the record, no revenue or fiscal impact, and it broadens the definition of compensatory mitigation to include activities to preserve functions and values of water resources of the state to compensate for removal fill-related adverse effects of a project. Changes the name of the fund to Oregon Removal Fill Mitigation Fund.
Okay. And Kevin, I think you're up again. Compensatory. Say it five times fast.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Moynihan, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands. and I'm here to testify today in support of House Bill 2156A. And what the bill is intended to do is twofold. Primarily, the intent is to change the language in the current statute that refers to the Oregon Wetlands Mitigation Bank Revolving Fund to change it to the Removal Fill Bank Fund. And the essence of that change is that it will make clear that we have the authority to accept into the current revolving fund with a changed name payments in lieu of mitigation that are for impacts to waters of the state other than wetlands. Currently, we have a very robust wetland mitigation program. We have 20 mitigation banks currently operating in the state. We also have, through the current Wetland Mitigation Bank Revolving Fund, a payment in lieu of mitigation option for developers, proponents who have impacts to waters of the state and wetlands, so they can pay into the fund. Monies in the fund are currently used to fund mitigation projects that compensate for the impacts. What we would like to do is to expand the authority and make clear by the name change that the department also has the ability to take into the fund impacts to waters of the state, streams, rivers, waters of the state other than wetlands, that we can similarly use monies in the fund to fund restoration projects for impacts to those types of waters of the state, and provide that as another compensatory mitigation option for project proponents who currently are still required under the current statutory language to provide mitigation for impacts other than to wetlands, but don't have as many options as are currently available for wetland impacts. The second part of the bill would allow us, the department, give us the authority to not only engage in compensatory mitigation involving the creation, restoration, or enhancement of wetlands, which is currently what the law allows, but also allow us, in certain cases where we have a special type of wetlands, those with endangered species, for example, or other types of unique features, to authorize mitigation in the form of preservation. So it wouldn't be only for creation, restoration, or enhancement. If we have a wetland or another water of the state that has unique features, for example, vernal pools down in the Medford area, they contain an endangered species, the fairy shrimp. They are considered to be an important type of feature to protect. The preservation option in the language change that we're offering to you will allow us to consider mitigation related to preservation for those types of unique and special features. So with that said, I'll be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Okay. Questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Not being from the southern part of the state, what's a vernal pool?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist. A vernal pool is a wetland feature where you have a very hard pack that lies underneath the ground and whatever vegetation is on the ground. Wetland features form on top of that very hard feature. It's a very unique feature that's found in southern Oregon and northern California. It does have unique creatures that live in those vernal pools, such as the fairy shrimp, which in fact look like shrimp. They're on the Federal Endangered Species Act list, and they're only found in these types of vernal pool features.
So,
Follow-up
question. So, because they're in southern Oregon, I guess the water temperature must be higher, and it's a hard pack underneath, as you're saying. So the water's trapped, surface water's trapped, similar to a bog, but a bog flushes out. So you get different species that form in it because of that strange place in the world, right?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, you said it better than I could. Oh. That's in colloquial terms, that is in fact accurate.
Okay.
If I may add, one of the problems with the vernal pools and some of the other features that are out there in the state that are very important to protect is you cannot just go out and create or even restore some of these features. The vernal pools, for example, there's been different attempts to try to recreate that type of a hard pack with that type of environment related to the temperature, the water, whatever it may be. And it's proven to be difficult, if not impossible, to create that. So the preservation option that we're proposing would allow us to preserve those features as a mitigation option because they're important enough to do so.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Okay, Senator Atkinson?
So if you could, on the vernal pool example, take me through how mitigation would work, because currently your agency blocks anything that would ever happen to them anyway, so there's nothing happening to any, your agency is proven to be a nightmare if the word vernal pool comes up on a piece of property. So tell me how you undo that nightmare through a mitigation process.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, on the vernal pool process, Department of State Lands, along with other state, federal, and local, and community
interests.
I'm
only worried about your agency. I know about the other ones.
Sure.
How does this work for just the fill and removal mitigation fund?
Senator Atkinson, this would allow us to authorize as a mitigation option proposed by a developer in the area who's got a project that may, in fact, impact a feature down in that area, including a vernal pool, to compensate for that impact by agreeing to preserve other areas down in that area that have vernal pool features. So there's complicated ratios that are being proposed that would allow a developer, in fact, to do their development, to impact perhaps even a vernal pool feature, but with a ratio to provide preservation for larger areas of vernal pools that would not be subject to development in the future. So the thought is that it actually allows development in the area where currently your perception is that it's stalled. That's probably true. Allowing us to agree with a project proponent that they can choose a mitigation option that would involve preservation because they can't create these types of vernal pool features would give them more options to go forward with their development.
Okay. Senator Boquist?
And I think, Madam Chair, we're talking like similar to a transferable credit or a conservation easement or something like that that could be transferred to another piece of property. Is that sort of what we're talking about?
Chair Infelder, Senator Boquist, that's essentially correct. So a developer would be allowed to develop on their particular property where their project is proposed, but they would transfer, compensate for that impact by buying credits in another property, maybe a mitigation bank,
right,
that would involve the preservation of probably a larger area of vernal pools than they're impacting.
Madam
so it's actually good for development.
Madam Chair.
Senator Przanski.
I mean, the bottom line is the vernal pools you're trying to preserve and protect, and you're going to work with the developer to either let them develop other parts around that property where that stays intact and won't be impacted, or if necessary, and or move them with other credits elsewhere where they'll be able to do something else and still maybe develop part of that other property that's in question?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Przanski, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's an attempt to set up a reasonable scheme that will allow development in a particular area while at the same time providing an appropriate level of compensatory mitigation. Yeah. We're currently, Senator Atkinson is correct, it's difficult to get there currently.
I mean, the bottom line is the bottom line is the vernal pools you're going to prohibit the development on top of or somehow is going to disturb that, but you're trying to work other accommodations that won't impact that area.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Przanski, that is correct. In fact, we have interest from mitigation bankers who are interested in coming into the area, currently discussions ongoing, who would be interested in selling credits that involve these preservation areas, which credits would be sold to developers down in the area so they could go forward with their development project while at the same time receiving the authority from us that they've met their mitigation requirement.
Yeah, it's similar. Is this a similar concept?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else would like to testify on this bill? Going once, going twice. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2156A. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2156A.
Madam Chair, I move that we send House Bill 2156A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Przanski has made a motion to send House Bill 2156A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Are there any discussion and any comments?
I'm going to be a no until I make some calls. Because quite frankly, we've tried a mitigation bank on vernal pools for years, and this agency has been nothing but the problem. So I don't know if I trust them. I want to make a few calls first.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. Any objections besides so noted from Senator Atkinson? Okay. With that, the motion carries. And Senator Przanski, thank you. Ed did such a great job in
mitigation.
Yeah. I think you'll do a fine job in carrying it on the floor. So with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2156A, and now we are on to hunting, on to the next agency.
This is my bill.
We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2218.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2218. For the record, there's a revenue statement was issued, and there is a fiscal statement as well. Increases the surcharge for resident and non-resident licenses from $2 to $4, and extends the sunset on all surcharges for 10 years to December 31st, 2019, effective upon December 30th, 2009.
Okay. We have Kurt Melcher from ODF&W. And is there a question about revenue? This doesn't have to go to revenue.
There is no subsequent referral on it at this point.
Yeah.
You think she's going to give me this one?
No, she's going to give it to me. She should have told me.
Okay.
She had the Buffalo bill last time.
Welcome, Kurt.
Good afternoon. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I will try to be brief here. I've provided copies of our written testimony as well on House Bill 2218A, and I'm reminded that Senator Atkinson requested that I move expeditiously through these items, so I'm going to do that. House Bill 2218A will extend the sunset provision on a very important program that we have. It's referred to as our Access and Habitat program. It's funded through a surcharge on our hunting licenses. It provides for purchasing access through easements on it's a public-private partnership type program. The current program will sunset at the end of this year. We're asking for that program to be extended for another 10 years. And additionally, the surcharge, which is currently $2 and has been $2 since 1989, I believe, we're asking to increase that surcharge to $4. Over the years, this program, since its inception in 1993, has provided access to over 1 million acres of wildlife habitat on private lands in Oregon. It's important across the state, both east side and west side. And during the 2007-2009 biennium, we have 58 projects in place across the landscape. The program's undergone several revisions over the years, and currently we have, as part of this bill, a request to reduce the number of applicant names that are required to fill some seats on the Access and Habitat Board. So, for instance, the current statute requests that for any of the private landowner representatives that we provide 15 names to fill those seats. And 15 names has proven difficult to come up with at times, so we're asking for that number to be dropped to 5. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions, and I think there's several people in the audience that want to testify as well. Thank you.
Actually, I don't have anybody else signed up at this point, but we'll see if anybody else wants to come up. We do for another bill.
Okay.
But any questions for the department, Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because there's a revenue impact statement attached to it and looking at it, can you give me an idea, are sales up or down? And then I know your point of sales system has been having challenges.
Yes.
Lately, where are we with that? And since there's a revenue forecast, are we going up in sales, down in sales? And then lastly, given the economy, are we seeing more poaching or less poaching?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Senator Boquist, with regard to our actual hunting license sales, Nationwide, we've been generally in a declining trend. Oregon has mirrored that trend, although in the last couple years, and in particular in 2008 and in 2009, the early indications are we've seen a slight increase in actually the sales of our products, both hunting and fishing licenses. With regard to our point of sale system, we're coming up on an important deadline. Our deadline for application for controlled hunts is May 15th each year. As we come up with that on that deadline, we typically have hundreds of thousands of applications that were being processed through our point of sale licensing system. And over the last couple days, we've been experiencing severe slowdowns of that system. It's a privately operated system that we contract with a company to run. As a result of those slowdowns, we've extended our our application deadline. It was currently scheduled for May 15th. We extended it first to May 19th, and I think just this afternoon we're in discussions. We're probably going to extend that to June 1st because we want to make sure that we're accommodating our customers that are trying to purchase these applications. And did I leave one off, Senator Boquist?
Poaching. I'm working with the economy,
yes.
Whether poaching's up or down.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, with regard to trends in poaching, I think I don't have a good sense in that I can provide you a direct answer. Lieutenant Lane is in the office, in the building here today. He may have some additional information on that. I think we are seeing in particular areas where we have over the years lost some coverage in terms of enforcement coverage, we have seen increases. I don't know that we could attribute that to the state of the economy or just the state of our general enforcement efforts with regard to the number of troopers we have in the field.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. I was going to ask about the if you're seeing a decline, but Senator Boquist beat me to the punch. Regarding the change, I was going to say, hold on before we take off.
Yep.
Five persons. So this is mainly because you've been having problems recruiting. This is private landowners to serve, correct?
Chair Dingfelder, that's correct. The current statute requires that, I believe it's the state forester and the director of the Department of Agriculture, submit 15 names to the Fish and Wildlife Commission for a vacant seat on the Access and Habitat Board. And over the years, that's proved difficult to come up with 15 names. For instance, you have one vacancy, you have to go out and recruit 15 interested parties.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I can't even look at my water board.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much, Kurt. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2218. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2218A.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2218A to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2218A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections?
I'm going to look at it. I may change my vote on the floor, Madam Chair, but I'm a no now.
Okay. All right. So noted for the record, Senator Boquist. Motion carries. And Senator Atkinson, would you like to carry this bill? Okay. So Senator Atkinson, carrier. And next up is the bill we've all been waiting for.
You bet.
Is this Close right?
Line part two?
Oh, no. No, that one, did we save it? No.
This is it.
This is the bill we've all been waiting for.
Raise
did
it
I
right.
Close the work
We're
session
call
on
them
that?
In.
So I need to close the work session on House Bill 2218A first and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2221. I thought we'd have a room full of people on this one.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2221A, there's a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. No statement was issued. It creates the crime of sale or purchase of hunts for feral swine on public or private land. Requires a person or an employee of that person who acts as a land manager to hunt, trap, or to cause to be hunter trapped at any feral swine that roams on land, owned or controlled by that person if they know feral swine are present.
Okay. I have Kurt Melcher, and then Tom Wolf is on that. You wanted to testify on this bill? Okay. Just want to make sure. Okay, Kurt, so tell us why you're bringing us this bill today.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee.
For
the record, my name's Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we are bringing you today House Bill 2221A, which has been referred to by a number of names over the last several months, but we refer to it as our feral swine bill. Essentially, and we provided written testimony here as well as some additional background information, but I wanted to highlight what the problem we're trying to address here. And fortunately, in Oregon right now, we don't have a great problem or a large problem with feral swine. However, some of our states, in particular California to our south, and other states in the west, do have problems with feral swine. The most common way that feral swine populations have been established in California and Texas and others is intentional release of domesticated swine in the hopes and interest in generating a hunting opportunity. What we're trying to accomplish with this bill is twofold. First, eliminate the incentive for an individual to want to release feral swine. And that's the part about prohibiting the sale of hunts for feral swine. And then the second piece is recognizing that feral swine are a large issue with regard to the deleterious impacts they have on our native ecosystems, riparian areas, and also just with regard to our agricultural production lands. And so what we're looking for here is the bill stiffens the penalty for allowing feral swine to roam on one's land, and requires that landowner, if they have feral swine, to address that issue, or work with us, notify us. So that's a nutshell, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, I'll take questions from our committee members first. We'll start on this side, yeah. Senator House.
There's not a great problem in Oregon, fortunately, but
it, does it exist? Where does it exist? To what extent is it happening at all?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hass, we have isolated populations of feral pigs in Oregon right now. I believe we think that they number between 1,500 and 2,000, as opposed to, I think, the California population is, by some estimates, up to a million feral pigs. Ours are currently fairly isolated, and we're hopeful that we can keep them that way. So we do have them, not a huge problem, and we're trying to do things to keep that from becoming a problem.
Okay. Senator Atkinson?
Yeah. So I have about three questions. So you said that if somebody releases a pig, when they release them, if they're domestic, when you release them, they're not feral yet. Is that right?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, that's correct. There are, the Department of Agriculture has rules that describe what a feral pig is in terms of...
I carried that bill, believe it or not.
Okay. And
it was
and
a thriller.
Yes. And
you have a chance to carry
oh,
this.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
No, I have
volunteer.
A way of getting rid of it. But anyway, but you made a statement that said that if somebody gets them on their property and lets them go, it's the hope that they'll take and create this business. You don't want that. But they're not feral for at least a generation, correct?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, if they don't meet the definition of a feral pig, the Department of Agriculture's definition of a feral pig, then they never come under the purview of this bill. So if, for instance, they're releasing these pigs on private property and they meet the Department of Agriculture confinement regulations, in other words, they're fenced, then they never qualify as a, they would never become considered a feral pig.
All right.
Follow up?
Yeah. Where is it that a person, where is it, is this the last section of this bill, section 3, where you made a statement about somebody that is responsible for feral pigs on their land? Where is that in
right.
the bill?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, that's correct. It is in section 3.
Where? What line?
Section 3, the full section, a person or employee that acts as a land manager may not knowingly allow these things to roam. And then it says that a person or employee of that person shall hunt, trap, or cause to be hunted or trapped if they're on their land. Or it gives essentially an out in that if they contact the Department of Fish and Wildlife and indicate to us that they're attempting to deal with those animals, then...
Thank you. Here's the hang-up I have with this bill, believe it or not. We're worried about these things getting out.
right? We're worried about the population growing. So every few sessions we have these bills around here to deal with feral swine. But here's a real world situation. So my beloved Stella gets invited to go hunting at a fundraiser, my dog. So I drive her. That's the request. I get to drive her. So I go out to Wild Horse Canyon to go to a fundraiser. Wild Horse Canyon's the old Bhagwan Ranch. So we go out there and my dog retrieves, and it's a big fundraiser, great time. We raise all this money for these youth kids that are now at the Bhagwan Ranch, that are now turning their lives around, bouncing on play gym stuff, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the next morning we get up, and we decide we're going to go shoot some pigs, you know, kind of a southern eastern Oregon thing to do, so we go and shoot these pigs. So if we pass House Bill 2221, you're telling me that the ranch manager for Wild Horse Canyon has got to provide your department with a plan to deal with pigs that may or may not be on his land, number one. And number two, you're saying that because this was a fundraiser for kids' camp and we're out shooting pheasants and et cetera, and then one morning we decide to go see if we can find some pigs, now we're all criminals, correct?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, this bill says it's unlawful to sell hunts. It does not say it's unlawful to hunt pigs. So
there's a fundraiser.
Yeah, no, the purpose of the fundraiser was the day before. The next day you're going out socially mm-hmm. with someone that manages land to do what you can do on your own land.
Yeah, it's different from selling. Yeah. Yeah, it's different from selling.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Axon, yeah. Nothing in this bill stops someone from hunting pigs. Yeah, in fact, it encourages it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Huh.
Okay. Senator Boquist?
A follow-up question here, technical question. So you said there's places in Oregon that we have these, and obviously they expand out, or you know they multiply and expand. So where, I mean, I see a little gray spot. That must be the Bhagwan Rajneesh, you know, former ranch over there. And here we go. Okay, more pictures.
You look at, see, they're showing how they're expanding or where they're finding them in these different counties.
Right.
Just compared to, you know, my homeland down here. They're everywhere.
Well, that's because you thought, don't use your ammunition to shoot pigs, obviously.
So is there a question there, Senator Boquist?
No, I'm just trying to figure out where the pigs are at.
Okay.
Pigs don't fly.
There's little pig feet marks in the...
Figure four.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So how'd those pigs get in Lincoln County? Would they take light rail?
There's no light rail over there.
Do you have a follow-up question, Madam Chair?
Okay, follow-up. We do have
here.
Other people that would like to testify in this bill, believe it or not.
But that is a good question. I mean, it's a considerable amount of expansion here. Is that because you think people have actually been transporting them over there and planting them there? Or is it because farms have given up and they had pigs and just let them go wild? That is a significant...
Yeah.
You've heard girls go wild, pigs go wild.
Right, pigs don't fly, okay?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, we certainly think that there are some individuals out there that are currently releasing pigs intentionally. We don't believe that these aren't generally believed to be agricultural escapees. They're far too valuable, and we know that the producers have obviously a vested interest in keeping their stock.
One final question, Madam Chair, because I've seen Betsy Johnson asking this. Is there anybody that we know of that's actually selling feral swine hunts?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, not that I'm aware of at this time.
In Oregon.
I was going to say as far as I know.
Thank you. Big business in Texas,
California.
California, yes.
Believe it or not, I read a book recently about hunting feral swine. Had a hunt of a feral swine in there. That's how I knew about this issue. Okay, thank you, Kurt. We actually have a couple of fish guys that want to come speak on pigs, so this is going to be interesting. Tom Wolf and Dave Moskowitz.
Your gun with you.
Aquatic pigs.
Yeah, is there aquatic pigs? We don't know.
They swim, though. They don't fly, but they swim.
Do we have a new hybrid species that we're going to learn about?
Wolf lessons across the river.
They came out of Coos County.
Why don't you go ahead first?
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Travel Limits. So why is a fish person up here talking about feral pigs? That's a good question. And I want to start with a little story. In 1542, long time ago.
The conquistador
de Soto took a force of men up from Florida and wandered around the Southwest and ended up around St. Louis for a number of years fighting with the Native Americans in probably the most densely populated area of pre-Columbian United States, host to what they estimate were millions of inhabitants inhabiting large villages up to 30 or 40,000. Along with the soldiers, De Soto brought with him hundreds and hundreds of pigs, which escaped from his army and became not only a tremendous negative impact on habitat, but were the cause and spread of numerous diseases that wiped out those native populations. So when we talk about feral pigs, we're not talking about something that just normally just escaped from your farm. We're talking about a species of pigs that have lived in the wild for 400 years and have a lot of people like to hunt them, and they will take those feral pigs that originally were found in southeast United States and spread them to other parts. So they are inbred species of pigs that have lived for a long time. They're not just something that hops off someone's farm. And the reason they're so dangerous to fish is because feral pigs do not have a sweat gland, and so therefore to keep cool they have to burrow in wetlands and in riparian areas, and they literally destroy miles and miles and have of habitat along streams and in wetlands. And they've done studies at the University of Georgia, University of Tennessee on streams there, and they've noted that the destruction of feral pigs is the largest demise of stream habitat in certain parts of that state. And whereas we do not have a huge problem here in Oregon, I applaud and support this bill because it will head off a situation that could possibly be get rather large. So therefore, as a fish group, even though, needless to say, feral swine are not fish and not aquatic, we do support this bill because it will put in place practices that will protect our habitat, protect our native species of fish, and create something that's a very small problem from getting larger and hopefully eliminate it altogether in the future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're going to hear your story.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here on behalf of the Native Fish Society today. I don't have nearly the grasp of history as Tom does. Yeah.
I'm impressed.
So it is very impressive. Yeah. Native Fish Society supports this bill because of the effect of these animals on riparian areas, which support all kinds of aquatic critters, including native fish. And it also, in trying to control these animals, you're helping economic productivity, not just for healthy watersheds, but also for forest and farm producers, who also suffer losses when these pigs can get in established. And the legislature is going to consider about a dozen bills on invasive species control, and it's a very significant accomplishment on a range of issues, and this is just one of them. There's another bill out there on tansy ragwort, which everybody loves that name, but it's a serious issue. And feral swine, there's lots of good reasons to joke about it, and it provides us a moment of levity, but it could be a serious issue. This gives the state a chance to get a handle on that, and we support this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions, except the ones about U.S. history.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2221A? I am going to we're not going to work this bill today because there's some questions the chair has that I've asked the department to find out for me.
I'm not convinced either, ma'am.
What?
I'm not convinced either at this point.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Just a comment on the bill.
Yeah.
Here's what I really don't like about the bill. All kidding aside, it's the definition. A person may not offer for sale, sell or purchase a hunt. The first section, the first line. I wish the line mirrored the language that was put into place on the Tui Chub or in moving fish around from lake to lake with those penalties. I'm really nervous about the word hunt in that line. I don't care for it. I mean, if
there's private hunts that take place on people's ground all the time, and if somebody is out hunting a deer, an elk, or upland bird, and they come across a swine and they shoot it, which is the right thing to do, it's conceivable that somebody could complain and say that that landowner was selling the purchase of a hunt for a feral swine. And I don't think that's what anybody is intending here, but I wish the language didn't say hunt in it. I wish it said something similar to what we did when we said you can't introduce fish to a different body of water, you can't move them around, you can't transport them, and if so, there's criminal implications. I really don't like the word hunt.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to ask, since it seems like a couple of us have some questions, I might ask Senator Atkinson, you want to meet with the department and report back to the
chair? They would be delighted to meet.
I know that they would, yes.
In response to Senator Atkinson, I mean, I do realize the hunt is an essential key of what they need to do to control this. I mean, if you go to Texas and some of these other states, I mean, it is big, big bucks.
Yeah.
And so one of the ways you keep the spread and introduction is not allow for those type of activities to go on. Now, I take what you're saying. I understand that if you've got a private landowner who's out there and they come across them, you don't want them to be caught up in the sense of being promoting some type of a hunt that, like the example you gave, but clearly it seems to me that you have to have some limitations and prohibition of these, call it professional for game hunts.
Right. Well, I think it's just a matter of some semantics here, and I'm going to ask the department to meet with the chair and the vice chair, and I think we'll be able to figure this out.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2221A. I have some other issues, so we'll meet with us. And Beth will set that up. And we're going to open up our last public hearing, which is on House Bill 2219A. Beth?
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2219A has a no revenue impacts statement and a minimal fiscal impact. There's no statement issued on it. It extends the sunset on landowner preference takes program to January 2nd, 2014.
Okay, and once again, we're going to hear from Mr. Melcher. I have some other issues I want to get together. Good. Beth, extend it up.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I appreciate having the time to come talk with you today about House Bill 2219A. House Bill 2219A refers to our landowner preference program. Our landowner preference program was designed to provide landowners with the guaranteed opportunity to hunt on their land, which is particularly important in our controlled hunt areas, where many landowners under the general draws would not be able to hunt on their own land except for very infrequently. This program allows them to hunt every year on their own property. The program began in 1981 and has been modified a number of times over the years. And most recently, in the mid-1990s, the program was amended to also help landowners and in terms of compensating them for much of the damage or some of the damage that they incur from the state's big game species that's damaged, agricultural damage on their property. The last significant change then was in 1995. When the sunset date was placed on the program, a 15-year sunset to extend the program through January 2nd, 2010. So we're here before you today asking you to extend that sunset, and House Bill 2219A includes a 4-year extension through January 2nd of 2014. The rest of the program would remain intact as it currently stands. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Broquist has a question. I'm just, I have one too, but go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, a comment and then maybe the Deputy will respond. I mean, it's been a pretty good problem, but we have a lot of agricultural issues, and I think the Deputy Director's aware. I've got the Crookshanks Farm that's in my district out past Dallas towards Sheridan, where there were 13 elk 4 or 5 years ago, and they're 60 or 70 now tearing up their fields as we speak today, And they're still trying to work with the department to get stuff through. This is just another one of those tools to do that. But we continue to have agricultural deprivation because of these large herds that, of course, want to come feed on the new crops we plant. So,
And I think we have some agricultural folks that would like to come up and speak on it. But do you want to respond?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist. This is a very important program for the department in terms of our ability to try and maintain good relationships with the producers, recognizing the benefit that they provide for the state's wildlife, not just big game, but all Oregon's wildlife. So we think it's an important program. We certainly want to see the sunset extended, and we plan on talking with groups over the next several years to consider additional modifications to the program.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I'll wait, and I'll probably talk to you offline. I have a question about this, but it's not essential to passage of this bill, so it's fine.
Okay. Thanks.
It has more to do with the revenue, so that's a different question. I will have, let's see, we have Bob Weber, Katie Fast, and Jim Welch. Welcome.
Senator Dingfelter, members of the committee, I'm Bob Weber. I represent the Oregon Hunters Association. Because of the sunset coming up, the department had a landowner preference review committee with the stakeholders, cattlemen, Farm Bureau, hunting organizations, and it started in late 2007. And we worked through these, or worked on these problems. I think that at this point, the Oregon Hunters Association supports this bill. I believe that the other stakeholders agree with supporting this bill. It's not perfect. Nobody is in love with the situation. It basically extends the current law for another 4 years. Hopefully in that period we can have some serious dialogue to address the issues of compensation for the landowners who suffer damage, and the hunters certainly recognize that the private landowners in this state contribute a great deal to our wildlife, and that our wildlife in that regard causes them damage. And hopefully with this sunset, we can arrive at some solutions to compensate those who are damaged. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Once again, for the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are supportive of House Bill 2219A, which extends the sunset. About 70% of wildlife habitats found on private land, depredation, and is a critical issue for the agricultural producers in Oregon. And this is one of the only quasi-compensation programs there are out there. As you see in the department's testimony, there's about 6,300 landowners that are participating in this program statewide, and we're supportive of the sunset being extended.
Okay. Thank you. Jim.
Chair Dingfelder and committee, Jim Welch, representing the Oregon Cattlemen and Oregon State Grange, and we're supportive of extending this sunset in 2219. We spent quite a bit of time, the cattlemen did, on the review work group, and we came to the session and we had a proposal in our hand that we were going to submit that would address this a little further, but we decided to pull it back. We're very concerned about compensation, and the dynamics on the ground out there have changed over the years since this program was implemented back in the 80s. And a lot more ground is irrigated, so it really does attract, you know, the deer and the elk. And so we do have some things that are happening out there that are causing certainly more damage on these ranches and farms. And we would like to continue to work on it, and we will. We just couldn't come to agreement on the first draft of the bill that was introduced this time. And doesn't mean we won't continue to work together and work on it, but we will. And we'll see what we can do to help the landowners and also make sure that we don't leave our hunters out of this. Thank you.
All right. And so you do support this version of the bill, I'm hearing right, Jim, correct? Okay. Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay. You got off easy. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill before we close the public hearing? Okay. With that, I would close the public hearing on House Bill 2219A, and I'll open up a work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2219A to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2219A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections?
That bill should pass.
Okay, seeing none.
I'd like to carry it if possible.
You would? Okay. Uh-huh. So the motion carries, and Senator Atkinson is going to be our carrier. And with that, colleagues, ends our close-up work session for House Bill 2219A. And we are actually very efficient because we're done. Didn't have to stay late tonight. So with that, we'll close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Reminder, there is committee tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
And we're here tomorrow.